Chapter 29. The Alliance Over Kharguenyan. Sir Kay and Lady Estrith did not wed that day, of course, but with the Baron's permission and blessing, that evening they solemnly appeared before a priestess of Ishi, the goddess of love, and plighted their troth, binding the agreement with wine, honey, and bread as tradition demanded. Alia and I both witnessed, as did Sagal, Tyndall, and Sir Festeran. There were tears and smiles in abundance to feed the goddess demand for tribute. They set a date for late autumn, after the harvest, and I suggested that if they scheduled it to coincide with the beginning of my magical fair, I would be happy to pay the bill for the festivity. They eagerly agreed, and pledged to meld their affairs together enough to begin the legal process of Sir Kay, Castellan of Sevendor, becoming Sire Kay, Lord of Kharguenyan domain in his own right. I wasn't worried about him running off with his bride and founding his own dynasty. He knew better than I did how expensive that was, and he had all the amenities of founding a dynasty in Sevendor, without the expense. And as a lord of his own estate, he was about to understand the importance of those expenses, especially a troubled little estate like Kharguenyan. Lady Estrith's estate was a single manor with attached hamlet, surrounded by 350 acres of rough and rocky hill country that was good for little other than hunting, pasture, timber, wildflowers, and bees. Kharguenyan domain had two streams and a pond, 60 acres of marginal grain fields under cultivation, 20 acres of meadow, a few small pastures, 4 small isolated stands of timber, and the only sanctified shrine to Noapis, the goddess of bees and honey, in 3 counties. Kharguenyan hamlet had less than 50 souls within, I learned. The manor house was slightly more grand than a prosperous peasant's home, and had no protective wall, just a high hedge and shallow dike. 2 aging retainers were all that stood between Lady Estrith and cooking for herself. Her daughter from her first marriage, little Lady Faresa, a darling little girl with the biggest brown eyes and the waviest dark hair, was only 4 years old, and away from home for the first time. Faresa instantly adopted baby Menalian as her favourite toy. Darishi didn't even seem to mind the help when the squealing little girl stopped by our encampment after the ceremony with her beaming mother. Lady Estrith was grace personified as she dealt with the demands of officially meeting her future husband and his household, but there was no mistaking her enthusiasm and delight. From that point on, she was with Sir Kay as often as possible. They were both still a little dazed and stiff to each other, formally polite and cautious in their dealings in public. Yet there was an undeniable and growing affection that was both amusing and inspiring to witness. Cautiously, they courted at first, gingerly holding her hand while walking, leading her in their first dance together at the celebratory ball that night, the way he awkwardly realized he suddenly had another person to be aware of at all times. But by nightfall, she was lightly in her cups and seated in his lap with great familiarity. Sir Kay appeared more than a little awkward and uncomfortable in his new role, but also clearly still enchanted with his unlooked-for bride. I got the pleasure of witnessing the expression on his face when he realized for the first time that he was going to be, and legally speaking already was, a stepfather, too. Alia and I watched the 3 of them for a while that afternoon, as the couple was fitted for new clothes in matching colours. Red and gold, not black and yellow. Sir Kay's colours. And then that's when Sir Kay and Alia got the rare pleasure of watching my face, as I realised that Kay would no longer be, entirely, my man. When the paperwork was finished, after their wedding, he and his bride would jointly swear fealty to Baron Arathaniel of Sindaria. I read the terms of vassalage myself, just to be sure I knew what they entailed. I was still new to feudal law, but they were straightforward and reasonable. Sir Kay would owe Sindaria 2 weeks of military service to His Excellency per year, providing 1 lance and 3 archers with the Baron's option for paid service for an additional 2 weeks. He had to provide 100 weight of honey for the castle every year, 20 bushels of oats in autumn, and a pig at Yule. He was charged with maintaining a stretch of road in the fief, both bridges, and could be forced to yield the contents of his pond to the Baron in a time of siege. He was to keep the Baron's counsels, act as his loyal agent upon request, and extend to him, and expect in return, limited rights of hospitality, should Arathaniel feel like visiting the decrepit old stony plot. It was intriguing reading over Sir Kay's rights and responsibilities, too. He had the power of low justice over his hamlet, free peasants, not villeins, for the most part, the right to charge rents, a charter for the apiary, and a separate religious charter for the attached shrine. That was the first time I'd ever read a feudal religious charter. Basically, it granted the civil right for Carguenyan to host the shrine, employ a priest or priestess, hive, brother, bee, sister, keep records, perform rites, provide religious instruction, all free from baronial taxation, and granted it exclusivity. No one else in all Sendaria could legally set up a temple to Noapis, should they be so inclined. That exemption from taxation also allowed the manor to produce and sell a certain amount of honey tax-free to pay for the upkeep of the shrine. Baron Arathaniel was quite forthcoming about the place to me the next day when he and Lady Estret appeared at my camp with a young law brother to finalize the transfer. The monk was happy to regale me of the history of Carguenyan. The estate had carved off one of Baron Arathaniel's ancestors' domains and had been given to a loyal retainer who married an odd Lensley daughter a few generations back. When the lands proved too marginal for much grain, the family had capitalized on the beautiful wildflowers that grew along the ridges of Carguenyan and turned to the blessing of Noapis to survive. They produced honey of superior quality and limited supply. After paying upkeep on the shrine, the surplus had been just barely enough to make up for the crappy land and keep the place going peacefully for a few generations. Then the bee lords of Carguenyan had lost two promising sons and a score of peasantry in the damnable Lensley dynastic disputes. The place barely recovered, the line producing a single daughter, the next generation, in which the domain placed all of its hopes. Lord Estret's father had gone into debt to educate her and make her a fit enough bride to attract some handsome and hopefully wealthy son-in-law and heir. He'd died, thinking he'd succeeded. Lady Estret's first husband was the recognized and ennobled bastard of some viscount, and he'd set him up decently, enough to buy out the place's original debt when he came of age. They'd enjoyed almost 2 good years before he was called to Faris by ducal decree, just like I had been. He'd died of a fever shortly after his return, leaving Lady Estret in perilous straits, a young orphaned widow with an infant daughter to care for, living in a debt-ridden estate of 50 peasants and a single aging beekeeping priestess. She didn't even have enough men to fulfill her military obligation if invoked, or properly defend the place against raiders. There wasn't much else she could do. All she had was her comeliness, her wits, and the baron's rarely used feudal obligation to secure a suitable husband for her. Hence the tournament, where she managed to pick off a genuine knight in shining armor, Sir Kay of Sevendor. And he really was starting to realize that he had no idea what the hell he was doing. The lawyers and the priests took almost the entire day to negotiate the final marriage contract and resulting transfer of title and enfeoffment, and it was only my history of enduring Penny's constant lectures of legalisms that allowed me to keep up. Alia quickly got bored, so she collected Lady Estret, Lady Sasha, and a few other stray noble women and sensibly went shopping. As horrifying as that sounded to me, I was paying for the expedition. I also had a tidy sum in freshly inked letters of credit from the Temple of Ifnia. I mean, how much could they possibly spend? That left me, Sire Sigalan, Baron Arathaniel, and one of his chief advisers, a cagey old Sendari monk of Luin, Lord Brother Hamaris the Clever, at odds under the pavilion. With all that new smoke and drink I'd just procured, and all the lackeys running around doing our bidding, we did what any reasonable group of intelligent men will do in such a situation. We got blasted and talked politics. Everyone wanted to know my opinion on Duke Rad's attempt to up-jump himself into a throne, then the possible ramifications for my profession, class, and vocation in the future were topics of discussion. Both the churning war to the west of us and the dogged determination of the censorate to turn back the sands of time, no matter how bloody that got, preoccupied much of the sober end of our discussion. But after we dealt with the question of the Eastern Duchies, and the dead god, and the certainties of war, we cracked open the fifth bottle, and the third pouch of herbs, and turned our attention to what I was most concerned with currently, local politics. "I will not lie to you, Mage Lord," Sire Sigilan sighed. "Watching you abuse the war bird was like a Yule gift from the gods. The possibility of, well, let's call it an alliance with Sevendor, also pleases me. Your man, Bannermore, he seems to have arranged a lucrative trade that could turn to real industry for my folk in time. But the trade is dependent on Sire Gimbal not molesting our precious red mud on the road. He could find ways to kill the enterprise ere it ever profited a penny," he said.
"Yes, I heard about that," snorted Arathaniel jovially. "I'd like to have seen that. The arrogant fool. The warbird is a fowl we'll all have to pluck, whether we will it or not. It is good to see to a common good in a common foe."
He looked anxious for a moment, as he tried to decide if he'd said what he'd meant to say, then decided he had.
"I am no warmonger, but there will be war in the valley one way or another. That strutting cockerel Gimbal is vicious, but his brother is a thug out of fable. They've other brothers and half-brothers too in Flaria, where my kin once ruled."
He sniffed in a fit of remembered glories his roomy eyes had never actually seen.
"Ha! The Lensley line is still stronger than Stringrath's," dismissed the law brother. "Deep roots in the Bontol? Strong. Strong enough to bend a few years for a malodorous chicken to strut by and spring back all the mightier.
Lord brother Hamaris had practiced and prayed here all his life, apparently, and was as steeped in the local politics as a man could be, and he was clearly partisan. I found out later he was descended from a cadet line of the Lensleys himself.
I tell you true, the portents and omens have been clear. War will come, but it will be a war that sees the warbird roasted," he cackled.
Baron Arathaniel, who knew the man of longer acquaintance and was used to what seemed to be a practiced refrain, sniffed dismissively.
"You said that last, fair Ham, and we stand no closer to driving the Flarians out of Lensley lands. Do we not? Have the gods not sent us a powerful champion at a critical time? Is Sevendor not one of the Lensley lands? Are not our coffers filling robustly, Your Excellency?" he asked, with just the proper hint of obsequiousness.
"War burns profits like cheap smoke," observed the Baron thoughtfully. "A year's worth of labour spent on an afternoon of glory. Chivalry ascends, prudence fails. Duin's glory is not worth ruining Huin's vocation," he said, making the signs for both the war god and the earth god.
"Not unless Luin's wit and wisdom guide," Hamara said persuasively, invoking the lawgiver. "Coin spent on Duin's glory can buy empires with Luin's counsel."
His attitude did not surprise me. The god of law was always angling for a percentage, it seems. The old monk continued, "If the shards of the Lensley's former glory can be husbanded but a while longer, perhaps enough of a flame can be kindled to reforge it anew. If only enough to gut a bird." He looked pointedly at Sire Sigilan. I realized with a start that the old monk was trying to push Sigilan into swearing fealty to the Baron. I also remembered the issue had come up before. I could appreciate Sigilan's perspective. He valued Trestendor's independence, and even if his highland holding was sparsely peopled, raising the Baron's banner would buy him obligation with little in return. Oh, a pledge of aid in time of a crisis, but if that time didn't happen, then becoming part of the barony gave him nothing much in return for his fealty. My friend was a prudent lord, who thought of his people first. He would not saddle them with more taxes and more obligations for the sake of some imagined dynastic tie. But I could also appreciate Baron Arathaniel's position. He had the last solvent piece of a dynasty in his hands, with a couple of nasty neighbours with designs on both his rights and his lands. The Baron of Bocaraton was always angling to steal the lucrative port of Sendaria away, and did not mind using Gimbal as his proxy. I was most concerned with Gimbal, of course, but both of the Flareas and their allied domains were starting to throw their weight around the Pontal, from what my new friends were able to tell me. A friendly challenge at your frontier every now and then is one thing, or even an actual dispute over something legitimate. But Gimbal and his brutish brother were scheming conquerors, and not half bad at the art. If they had not hated each other as much as they did, they might have conquered Trestendor and a goodly portion of Sindaria, too. But now I was living here, and Sevendor definitely would alter the political nature of the valley. I suggested as much. Perhaps if Duin's glory, Huin's labor, and Luin's wisdom cannot see the way? Irentia's light will guide, I said lightly but decisively, as I sipped something citrusy and hard out of my silver cup. I tend to get dramatic when I have both an audience and a drink, and invoking an imperial goddess of magic among Narasi lords got a raised eyebrow or two. Magic is again at play in politics, my lords, and as you should know, just a spark of it can alter the course of empires. Lord Brother Hamaris looked at me unsteadily for a moment. I don't know what he'd been drinking, but there wasn't a lot left. Well, unless you can conjure 200 lances out of your ass, spellmonger, West Flareia means to take Sevendor's virtue. So say the portents. See, that's why magi dislike the mantic arts, I said conversationally, because when you make prophecy, you bind yourself to the fates from that moment. The fact is, any number of things may happen ere Flareia might march on Sevendor. Gimbal could die in a riding accident. Gimbal could die choking on a fishbone. He could die of pox, or fire, or flood, or his valet's overbite, if the gods so decree. Anything could happen. Of course, I had been trying to make them laugh to lighten the mood, but since I had their attention. My lords, where glory and tradition and resources prohibit, magic can sometimes produce the most amazing things, just by existing. For example, a small but important bond between houses, I said, indicating toward Sir Kay under the other pavilion. Sir Kay holds no lands from me at the moment, but he swears his sword to me. Aye, and a mighty sword it is, Amaris cackled. He showed his fitness for the prize on the lists. Good, strong stock, that Westman. A worthy addition to the shard of Lensley in Lady Estrit's bloodline, he said enthusiastically. In a score of years I foresee many strong sons, good loyal swords in Sindaria's defence. And I hear he knows his letters. He is well read for a country knight, I assured him, a capable minister of estates and an ambitious castellan. So, he only steals in the greatest of moderation, supplied the Baron, to which we all obligingly laughed more than the joke merited. To my knowledge, Sir Kay was too busy to steal. That does bring us back to the matter of this new domain, I said smoothly. I recall the price the barony would purchase it back for was 3,000 ounces of gold. That was about a nominal price for the place, admitted Hamaris, who seemed always ready to discuss business. Plus the debt, of course, he muttered. And how much has your excellency loaned the domain? Baron Arathaniel stroked his beard and looked into the air before answering. Since our last accounting, Lady Estrit has kept her debts to us manageable. 700-800 ounces of gold, I've extended her domain. If the bees hold this summer, her honey festival prospers, and the price the merchants offer her does not fall in the autumn, then your man can be on his feet in 2, perhaps 3 years, and I would be willing to extend him more credit if need be, Arathaniel added. He didn't look thrilled at the prospect, but if 80 or 100 ounces of gold could buy him a reasonably reliable steward of his property, that was not a poor bargain. Most landholding nobles were used to lending their liegemen money, and sometimes the resolution of that debt could take generations. I really didn't want Sir Kay entangled in that. I'll buy out that debt, I said simply. That's generous of you, Arathaniel said, studying me thoughtfully.
although I actually prefer my vassals be indebted to me. It keeps them polite. I can see the wisdom in that, I nodded as I packed my pipe. But I don't want Sir Kay so distracted by his holdings debt that he cannot manage mine properly. So I am removing that as an issue. When I came to Sevendor, I expiated all my subjects' debt. I also invested heavily in them afterward, and they have repaid that generosity with their loyalty, their tribute, and sometimes their blood. You came to Sevendor a rich man, then? Sire Sigilyn asked, appraisingly. Rich enough to keep my domain from starvation, I nodded. My reward for the Battle of Timberwatch. But most of that is gone now, and while I'll recoup some of it in the taxes my people will pay, I do not begrudge a penny spent in their support and prosperity. Sevendor is my home now. I shall endeavour to make it a good one for all, and I aim to help Sir Kay do the same. If it's a matter of mere money... There's nothing mere about coin, snorted Hamaris. If you can pay off Carguenyan's debt, Mage Lord, that gold can go right to our defence, or at least to securing arms. That might be as good as pulling 100 lances out of your ass, he howled, amused at his own wit. Something told me his buffoonery was affectation for mine and Sigilyn's benefit. But I offer a counter-proposal, I added, thinking quickly. I remembered what Bannermore had told me about the Baron's vassal in Birchroot, Lord Remias, and his problem with the bridge. I'll pay off 500 gold of the debt in cash, with a draft on the Temple of Ifnia. The balance will be paid by me restoring the stone bridge that leads from Birchroot to Jerun. I have an apprentice adept at stonework, and I shall dispatch him and the team at my own expense to put it right. That captured Baron Arathaniel's interest more than I thought it would. Ah, and the fact that opening up a strategic road directly into the heart of Sashtalia, to me, has, I'm certain, no influence on this purely commercial offer, he asked, his eyes twinkling. I had no idea the bridge was militarily important, but if a man thinks you're smarter than you are, it's rarely a good idea to correct him. Why, that had not even crossed my mind, Excellency, I said truthfully. I merely wished to ensure a goodly quantity of excellent leaf to the region and help out a friend. If you went to a regular stonemason, the cost would be as much or more as the difference between Carguenyan's debt and the 500 gold, and this way you have the additional assurance of having a spell-resistant, magically hardened bridge on your frontier. And one which the Lord of Birchroot would be eager enough to begin collecting tolls upon, added Hamaris approvingly. Then I shall be happy to accept your offer, Arathaniel said, looking a little more at ease. I could appreciate his apprehension about my offer. He already had one interloper on his frontier. He didn't need a second trying to win lands within his domain. More, I shall make a gift to Kay and Estret, to help them keep their feet under them. The sooner Sir Kay can fix what's wrong and throw money at the problems, the sooner he can get back to making Sevendor a fit mageland. The celebration that night was impressive. There was a more formal reception held at Chepstow Castle at the end of the fair, but as grand as the Baron's fete was, I'd like to think the Sevendori camp was where the real party was. This was a celebration not just of Sir Kay's victory, but of his upcoming union, the new alliance with Sindaria that resulted, and the resurgence of Sevendor, all rolled into one. Once again, I spared no expense to honour my castellan and his future bride, and I think we did a passable job. Sir Kay and Lady Estret were seated at a place of honour, under a small canopy, awkwardly eating from the same plate and drinking from the same cup. They got more comfortable with each other as the night went on, and exchanged many small kisses and glances, as if they were both unsure whether or not they were dreaming. We hired musicians for the event, and a professional team of victuallers. The celebration began with a delicious roast oxen feast and a barrel of ale, climaxed with speeches and blessings and the giving of gifts. I had Tyndall and Bannermore put floating mage lights all over the place in different sizes and colours, and I did a passable job of some firework effects after dinner. Then I spoke to my people. I congratulated all of the contestants
and even made special mention of Sir Tyndall's third-place success in the swordsmanship competition, and one of my better archer's accomplishments of taking second in the bow. Then I went into a rousing and highly embarrassing lauding of Sir Kay's prowess, Lady Estrid's beauty, and the attraction that resulted. I announced my purchase of Car Gwenyon's debt, much to Lady Estrid's shock and surprise, and then I presented the couple with a draft of 1,000 ounces of gold, drawn on Ifni's temple treasury in Sandaria. Sir Kay had tears in his eyes as he tried to accept the princely gift, and Estrid looked so grateful it was almost painful. But I didn't mind. It was only money, and money I had won on his efforts anyway. I could pay off Baron Arathaniel, pay for our entire fare going, and afford to give Sir Kay such a grand gift, and still ride home with coin in my purse. At the celebration I felt like a lord, perhaps for the first time. I started to understand what was implied with that title, what it should mean, and the shame that accrued when the practice of nobility failed to live up to the expectation, as was all too common. The last few days of the fair we began to pack up and even sent some wagons ahead of us, along with a couple of guards who were already pining for home. There was one other important, to me, event that happened. I met with several of the spellmongers in the area at an impromptu gathering, across the way from a glass vendor. I ran into Master Andalnam first, with all of his apprentices and daughters in tow, and collected my commission, which he had sent word was ready for delivery. Then Master Valenduin arrived to pick up an order in the company of a brother journeyman from Sashtalia, and Master Andalnam could not resist introducing me to his rival. Suddenly we were a small convention of spellmongers blocking traffic to the glasssmith. I offered to buy everyone around, and we ended up retiring to a nearby ale tent to talk shop before we left the fair. Two more spellmongers who knew Andalnam's eldest daughter happened by while we were there. I called Tyndall and Bannamor in, mind to mind, and asked them to bring Festeran, and soon it was a party. I outlined for them what the Robin Wing Conclave had produced to replace the bands, and what that would entail. I also used it as an opportunity to promote our magical fair, tell them about Snowstone, and had a few samples distributed, and told them about my dramatic showdown with the Censorate. I tried to get them enthusiastic about the changes, and I pledged choice spots for all of them at the fair if they pledged to come. We parted on very good terms, and I felt good about the impromptu meeting with my professional colleagues. Good professional relations are always a plus. The ball at Chepstow Castle that closed the fair was grand, and we attended as personal guests of the Baron. It was a lovely feast, one of the best I've attended, and I got to rub elbows with the finest lords in the Bontal Vale, and listen to their gossip and bellyaching. One sight I did not mind seeing was the glowering face of Sire Gimble. Propriety demanded he attend the ball, and he did so at a space respecting his rank and position, but once he'd heard about Sevendor's backdoor alliance with Sandaria through Car Gwenyon, he seemed to forget all about the wonderful food and wine, and spent the rest of the evening just glaring at us all. Alia was impressed by the style of the Lensleys, and loved their castle. We were both introduced to the aging Baroness, Arathaniel's wife, who seemed as taken with Alia as any noble woman had yet been. I got my share of attention from the noble women myself, forcing Alia to intervene a few times when my admirers got too friendly. We danced badly until long past midnight, and liberally toasted the winners of the various competitions as we enjoyed the comforts, delights, and entertainments of the high table. Once the honours were done, toward the wee hours of the morning, we poured ourselves into the wagons and slept while the drovers started us on the road towards Sevendor. Sir Festeran had overseen the striking of our camp and our preparation for departure, and Sir Roncil had turned up, after spending the evening somewhere mysterious, ready to oversee the guardsmen. I slept until we passed into Sashtalia, only waking up long enough to bid Sir Kay and his betrothed as he went off to inspect his new fief. Then I passed back out. I love a good fare.